Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Laura Stark, professor at Vanderbilt University. I had the great pleasure of interviewing Grace Davey about her recent book, Poverty Knowledge in South Africa, A Social History of Human Science, 1855 to 2005, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2014. Grace Davey is associate professor of history at Queens College, City University of New York. Poverty is political, not only in how it's debated, but how it's conceptualized and measured in the first place. Grace Davey follows the history of what she calls the poverty question in areas currently known as South Africa from the middle of the 19th century through the formal end in 1994 of the state-sanctioned racial discrimination known as apartheid and into the new millennium. The book follows two processes to show how the poverty question could remain perpetually unsettled. First, it explores how the poverty concept was created and recreated at different moments in time. Second, it looks at how poverty evidence has been authorized and marshaled by various groups and individuals over time, political leaders, labor unions, activist groups, church organizations, and scientists themselves, who only occasionally aligned with state agencies. So the story that Grace Davey tells is not a simple chronology, nor is it a story of how governments always preferred quantitative evidence over qualitative evidence, as many histories would have it. Instead, Davey proposes the term epistemic mobility to signal the process through which claims about what makes credible evidence continually toggled over time from statistics to stories and back again. So for anyone following the discussion of climate denialism at the current political moment, I would add that the concept of epistemic mobility can come in pretty handy. And one final note. What I especially admired about the book is it doesn't shy away from the questions of social justice and the delicate matter of how academics might respond politically to their own research findings. This interview is a collective effort. I read Davey's Poverty Knowledge along with graduate students in my seminar called Social Studies of Science, Technology, and Medicine. My co-interviewers were Tessa Eidelman, Christy Troutman, Molly Moreau, Alexis Mundo, Mary Catherine Robinson, Nivi Tazamarasan, Megan Ward, and Trixie Yabit. Thanks for joining us.
So thank you again for making time to chat. And we just really enjoyed reading the book and have lots of questions for you, some of which I was able to send yesterday. What I want to do first, though, is just give you a sense of our context, like physically how we're set up and who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a graduate class at Vanderbilt on new approaches to science and technology studies in particular.
Okay.
So I should say that anytime you feel like drawing out discussions that are particularly acute in African studies and African history, since that's not our specialty, that would be super because we're going to be sort of quiet on those sorts of debates, but we'd love to hear more.
Okay,
but,
wonderful. So the students in the class, hello, everybody, by the way.
Hi.
Can you tell me about how many students are in the class and disciplines? Are you sort of science studies students or?
Absolutely. I thought there's eight people, so we thought they would each go around and just say their name and give you a ballpark idea of where they're coming from.
Excellent.
Okay. Super. Tessa, you want to start off?
Sure. So hi, I'm Tessa. I'm a PhD student in a program called Community Research in Action, which is an applied social science degree. I'm actually from South Africa, and I'm studying issues of housing and social justice in Cape Town.
Hi, I'm Trixie. I'm a graduate student in the Medicine, Health, and Society Department here at Vanderbilt, and my research is focused around refugee resettlement and really looking at this time period and seeing how it's changing.
Hi, my name's Christy. I'm actually an undergraduate student, but I'm entering into the Medicine, Health, and Society master's program here at Vanderbilt next year.
Hi, I'm Alexis. I'm also an undergraduate student, and I'm entering the same program next year.
Hi, I'm Mary Catherine, and I'm a graduate student in Medicine, Health, and Society, and my research is focused on education and the relationship between stress and education.
Hi, I'm Molly. I'm a graduate student in the Medicine, Health, and Society department as well, and my research focuses on the medicalization of female sexual desire disorder.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm also in the Medicine, Health, and Society graduate program. My research is surrounding addiction and recovery.
Okay.
Hi, I'm the last one. My name is Nibby. I'm also in the Medicine, Health, and Society graduate program, and my research is on Syrian women within Syria and Lebanon.
Okay, fantastic.
So I think that this afternoon I inspired some of Mary Catherine's research by the stress with the computer that we were having. So we had a group building exercise here. So Grace, I just wanted we have lots of questions and about your research process and your framework and what you're working on now and these sorts of things. But I wondered whether it's okay if we just start recording and maybe mm-hmm. it'll work for the New Books Network, and we'll be sort of centering, of course, on Poverty Knowledge in South Africa, your wonderful book. But really, feel free just to keep it casual and open out in any directions that you like.
Okay, well, thank you so much for asking me to participate in the discussion, and I'm thrilled that you engaged with the book, and I really appreciated your very smart questions. I have to be honest, I only had a few moments. I just gave a midterm to 50 students in my African history survey, and I have a conference on Friday, so I have to admit I did not get to spend a lot of time sort of preparing, so my comments might be a little all over the place, but I'm so excited that you found the book interesting, and I'm thrilled to talk about it with you.
We really enjoyed reading it, and we're eager to keep the conversation pretty free-flowing. So I wanted to start off just by giving you a sense of how we read the book coming out of STS. And so looking at it, the book is about poverty knowledge in South Africa over a long period of time. So you're looking at changes from the middle of the 19th century until really into the 21st century. And you're interested in poverty knowledge as both a concept, so how conceptually this changed over time, and then in addition to that, what counted as legitimate evidence of poverty. So I wonder if you could start off by talking about this really important term that you use, which is epistemic mobility, and the idea that stories and statistics really factor in throughout the period that you're looking at. What are you getting at with epistemic mobility?
Well, thank you for asking me that, especially because I think of the STS concept in the book that seems to me to kind of jump out as an STS concept is the concept of co-production. But as I was writing the book, epistemic mobility became such a helpful phrase and idea for me. This book started as a seminar paper in my second year of grad school at the University of Michigan. And I wanted to write about the history of the social sciences in South Africa. And I thought one way to do that would be to follow the poverty line from its sort of importation and construction in South Africa in the late 30s and early 40s in Cape Town with the first household survey of Cape Town. And that I, in a sort of Latourian sense, I might follow that social technical actor, you know, out of the university context into fieldwork situations and then into political debates. And I did do that in the book, but then I also realized as I was researching and writing that there was, along with quantitative evidence of poverty, there was this other kind of competing archive of knowledge and information, qualitative information. And so I became just really curious about how these two kinds of knowledge were pitted against one another, were competing, were always in kind of tension and dialogue, and what, you know, how to understand over this long period of time how different kinds of claims about poverty were marshaled and were negotiated. With epistemic mobility, I think the best way, I think I compare it at one point to bickering twins. Or I think of these, of quantitative knowledge and qualitative knowledge as always kind of linked together in debates about poverty in South Africa. And I think it's just really important, I think, to recognize, because otherwise poverty experts and advocates and activists can get kind of caught off guard by the complexity of the question. You know, if it seems that the debate is settled, it's not settled, because this other sources of information can be brought to the surface and used to challenge, whatever in a particular moment is considered the legitimate knowledge of the issue. So I just wanted to kind of make people think about that instability in the poverty question, and what does that mean politically and ethically.
One of the things that I liked so much about the term of epistemic mobility is precisely the fact that it did seem like a term that could be so useful for other topics and other domains of research, and thinking about the issues of how it's productive in certain times for certain political actors to keep debates unstable. So thinking about how this concept would be really useful for people in STS looking at climate change, for example, how refusing, and you mentioned climate change in your epilogue as sort of one area where you have debates unsettled. The issue of this separate, or not necessarily separate, but additional layer of sort of a more hidden archive or shadow archive in which you have qualitative evidence coming up alongside quantitative evidence was so interesting, especially in characters that you show like Batson, who seemed to be one of the first sort of social science proper self-identifying human scientists in South Africa, where he took the idea of objectivity equaling statistics quite seriously, and yet he was doing it by looking at the through field surveys, the stories that people were telling. I was really curious about this actual archive. It sounds like a remarkable resource, these cards that showed the survey results. And along these lines, Molly actually was wanting to ask a little bit more broadly about the research process and what it looked like to produce a book that covers such a long period of time.
So you organize your book chronologically and thematically, and you provide a lot of really, really detailed information about the relevant individuals and how they contributed to the poverty question. So I'm just wondering, what was the research process to gather all this data like?
Oh, it was such a journey, Molly. as a process, it was just, I feel incredibly grateful that I had the opportunity to do this research, and I learned from so many people. I had so much help along the way. The research project was really all-encompassing, and it took a lot. You know, it did take a long time. It started as a dissertation, but as I was revising it as a book, I thought I was going to end in the 80s, and then I decided I really needed to bring it up to the present. So the research process for me involved trying to just throw myself into the question of how do people think about poverty over this long period of time. You know, E.P. Thompson's idea of the working class, it's not that it's a thing that suddenly just appears, working class consciousness. It takes a long, long time for people to start to have a feeling that there's something, they have some sort of similar experience that could be described as a class experience. And so, I'm not sure if I was thinking about that at the time, but I think when I, you know, as I was visiting all these archives, when I spent, I'm very grateful to Social Science Research Council and Fulbright that allowed me to spend almost 2 years in South Africa as a graduate student, and I just tried to go to all the archives I could that I thought would show me not just the published reports, but the sort of production of knowledge, and also, you know, government archives where I could sit and read testimony to state commissions of inquiry and see how chiefs and missionaries and educators were talking to representatives of the state about what they were seeing in their local areas. And also just talking to as many people as I could, student activists, labor leaders, academics today, and just trying to get a sense of how these ideas cohere but also don't cohere, and what were the moments. I think as it was coming together into a dissertation, I realized I needed to focus on the moments when the conversation seemed to flip. You know, for a period in the late late 19th century, early 20th century, qualitative evidence of poverty, especially white poverty, was treated as quite legitimate, and Afrikaner nationalists were ready to say it's not one number that we need in order to understand the so-called poor white question. We need to listen to poor whites. We need to understand why they're losing their racial identity or why they're at risk of sort of degeneration, and also how they could be lifted up. But then there was a flip in terms of quantitative knowledge becoming the standard bearer, and that happens I certainly don't see South Africa in isolation. It was in many parts of the world in the 30s and 40s after the Great Depression, the worldwide depression, that there was a demand for objective scientific knowledge of standards of living that could be compared. But then it flips again in South Africa with the liberation struggle and with the Black Consciousness Movement, with a major, what I think is a really important general strike in Durban in 1973, and with the drive to sort of understand how to end apartheid. You know, what kind of knowledge would be effective in finally achieving sanctions internationally and enforcing some kind of change. So I think in terms of the research process, I think what helped me to write the book is just to give myself the time and sort of be patient with myself in terms of sitting with the messiness of all the evidence and taking the time to see how did it come together. And I certainly, when I started to write the book, I didn't imagine that I would be writing a book in which I argued that disruptive protest is really key to the making of human science knowledge. I think I only learned that by immersing myself in the realities of South Africa over the 20th century. So the process was messy and often very challenging, but I was just really lucky to have been trained as an undergraduate by historians of South Africa, Clifton Craves and Pamela Scully, and then to be at the University of Michigan, where they were just very inspiring people and really provocative questions about colonialism and about how to understand knowledge in relation to colonial power. So the process was really transformative. I feel like writing this book kind of made me a different person. So I think it's really my advice to graduate students is to really pick something that you are excited and passionate about, and also find a kind of archive that seems to go on forever, because those are the archives where, you know, it's good, I think, as a student to find a question where there's much more than you could say. You would need an endless number of books to be able to really, where the question itself has no sort of end. And I felt like that with this project, it could just go on forever. Sometimes I wish I was able to write a book that wasn't 300 pages and that summed up everything in 50, but maybe my next book will be shorter.
Well, it so nicely showed the dynamic, and one of the things that we were remarking on as we were reading the book is just going through your footnotes, the material that you were looking at and had access to, it just did seem like multiple dissertations, multiple books could be written, and especially the field survey materials that you were looking at were just really tremendous. One of the things that I especially admired about the book is that you don't actually start it when human scientists proper are on the scene. You actually begin the book by talking about how there are ways of figuring and thinking about want and sort of destitution that were already on the ground that actually human scientists had to plug into when they were arriving from this more international scene of social science survey methods that were taking off. And you show that the book is sort of bookended by two different Carnegie Commission reports. and show really nicely how in the first report, early on around the turn into the 20th century, one of the concepts that actually was really stabilized along with poverty as a concept was the idea of the poor white, and that this was always in contrast to the idea that actually non-whites did not experience poverty, or it was something else when it was discussed in terms of them, that it was simply their primitive natural inclination and primitive circumstances. So poverty seemed to be inflected with the sort of this racial hierarchy as well. So this prompted some other questions that we had about your key terms.
Okay. So you mentioned this a minute ago, but throughout your
book... Who is this again? Can you just reintroduce yourself?
Yes.
Megan, okay. Hi.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. So throughout your book, you kind of use this term co-production, which you mentioned a minute ago, as a major theme. Could you just tell our listeners kind of what that term means and how exactly it fits into your analysis of poverty knowledge in the book?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I use co-production in a very general way to say that we have to, if we're going to write about the history of human science, which involves experts trying to understand human consciousness and social life, then we have to be ready to see how those experts are sort of pushed and pulled by the people that they're writing about and their ideas and their ways of talking about their experiences. I've been really inspired recently by this short and very beautifully written essay by Laurent Dubois called Enslaved Enlightenment, which really argues that slaves contributed to the Enlightenment, and so did slave revolts, and so did the writings of plantation owners who were concerned about slavery in the Black Atlantic and the Atlantic world. I think I was trying to do something somewhat similar as writers who write about the Black Atlantic, in the sense that I wanted to insist, and of course scholars in subaltern studies, I wanted to insist that people who do not leave written documents still contribute to the shaping of expert knowledge, the shaping of the categories used by the state. And that even though it's very difficult to recover their influence on written documents and on scientific categories, it's still incumbent on us to try and to ask the question. I think one of the real weaknesses in this book is that I don't speak African languages. I lived in Harare for a semester. I was lucky to be able to study abroad in Zimbabwe when I was an undergraduate, and I studied E.C. Shona. I had, before I went to South Africa in Washington, D.C., I had an E.C. Xhosa tutor, and I learned some greetings and some, you know, a few basic words. I did a summer course on in Afrikaans, thinking that would help me in the archives, reading documents, and I cannot speak any of those languages. I mean, I'm just a total failure at language in terms of my own abilities. So I think one of the real limitations in this book is that I'm relying on text and translation. And so to the extent I'm able to hear African voices in the archives, it's often in translation, it's very mediated, and of course a lot of this sort of testimony that I'm looking at was given in situations where people were trying to negotiate getting something from the government or trying to deal with, you know, the effects of the mining industry on their life, with the past system, with lack of housing, with inflation. And so there are all these ways in which I'm really not able ever, and I'm not sure one ever can, but I'm never able to get to a sort of pure, unmediated indigenous experience. And I hopefully I don't pretend to do that in the book, but I certainly think it's essential to ask the question of, you know, how do people who are not treated as experts, not treated as authorities, still shaping expert categories? So that was what took me back to the mid-19th century. I thought I was going to start in the 40s, and then it seemed clear that I really had to understand the production of social science in this broader colonial context. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that there are that there is not only different stories being told, but that the evidence itself is changing. Mm-hmm. So it's moving from quantitative to qualitative. Mm-hmm. Seemed to be like one of the really the nice themes.
Yeah, you mentioned climate. Can I just jump
yeah,
back to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I mean, in terms of epistemic mobility, I think it could be useful to people looking at debates about rising temperatures, because there's always that tension. I think, for me, I think epistemic mobility could be applied to any scientific problem where there's just deep and enduring unsettledness over evidence. You know, what kind of evidence really counts? And I think with climate, you do see there's moments where, you know, the atmospheric, you know, hard science data is treated as the most credible. But there's other moments where it's, you know, flooded streets or drought or, you know, deaths due to heat waves or, you know, the way that the air feels or, the look of the landscape. There's times when it's your own personal firsthand evidence that is taken as more credible. So there is, I think, there that tension. Also, I would love to, I think in a way, epistemic mobility could be used to explore debates in American history about the founding fathers. Because if you think about the long, long dispute over Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, the question was whose story counted. Was it the documents, the sort of official documents left by Jefferson and people around him, or was it the stories that people told about his relationship with Sally Hemings that were transmitted orally? Ultimately, the DNA evidence showed that there was this relationship that had been talked about for so long. I don't know. I think there's so many sort of questions about that involve unsettled debates where there is this kind of tension over evidence.
Yeah, and it seems like for all of the accounts in the line of sort of the great work by Ted Porter, which you're very sympathetic to, and almost raising a temptation to think that there was a march a progressive march where the state was increasingly using quantitative evidence as the most credible and most authoritative. I mean, you're showing not only in the early period, but also in the later period, that that political leaders were constantly toggling back and forth at these different moments. I mean, one of the issues is in terms of doing a history of a concept is the idea of there being sort of a residual of earlier periods. Of some ideas that stay with a concept. And Mary Catherine was thinking in these terms and wanted to explore this a little bit more.
Okay, you guys are asking such wonderful questions. This is very gratifying for me to hear you respond to the book, so thank you.
Could you elaborate on the different frameworks you use to engage with this research, like when you started and just throughout the research process?
Yeah, there were a lot of different frameworks. Was there one, tell me your name again, it's Mary?
Mary Catherine.
Mary Catherine, yeah, were there specific frameworks that you were noticing or that you wanted me to comment on?
any of them, I any mean, just like what your initial thought was, but we connected to hacking a few times.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes, maybe the looping dynamic idea?
Yes.
Yeah, so that was really important to me. Hacking's work was just so inspiring to me as a student and when I was thinking through the data. So his idea of looping dynamics, I think it's really easy to grasp, and I think once you think about it, you realize it's happening all the time. And the basic idea is that expert categories, expert knowledge becomes the way we talk about our own lives. We start to rewrite our life story using a diagnosis or a finding or a term that is put out by health experts or by, you know, other kinds of experts. So, for example, I think psychologists have looked at resiliency. You know, there's been a lot of research in the last 10 years on resiliency. What makes communities and people resilient? Foundations kind of jump on board and they offer grants. And then people write grants and they make arguments that they are resilient and they sort of think about themselves and their lives. And there's all kinds of ways in which people start organizing using expert categories. Certainly you see that in my book where people are talking about living under the poverty datum line. And so there's a way in which you can think about looping dynamics. A sociologist of knowledge, Barry Barnes, wrote about this as well. It's not only Ian Hacking. And also Kurt Danziger, Canadian historian of human science and psychiatry, has written about this too. I think it's a really powerful concept, you know, that scientific categories become the way we make claims in our everyday life. And also the way in which, you know, governments begin to try to organize society using scientific concepts. But I think for me, epistemic mobility is different because it's about the inherent instability within a concept like poverty. So as I was saying before, I started to feel I really needed to understand what exactly cause this instability and how, you know, at the end of the book, I end with a discussion of debate about development. And I just noticed that, you know, these representations and questions and even like words seem to kind of come back. In the 1980s and 1990s, there was these representations of poverty that seemed to be recuperated from the 20s and 30s. So I think both epistemic mobilities and the Foucauldian concept of archives of knowledge is helpful for me in terms of trying to just find some way to talk about the layers within a scientific concept that go back quite far in time. And it can be kind of like hidden, can suddenly kind of pop up again, which I think in a lot of ways my book is kind of challenging ideas about authorship and authority, because I think there's certain SCS concepts that could allow you to think that experts really have a lot of agency. They really sort of set out with their plans, and then they go forward, they enroll allies, and they kind of create new fieldwork situations, and they sort of prescribe behavior with their technologies. And what I was trying to show is, look, experts are really embedded in all kinds of complex dynamics, including revolutionary dynamics in a society like South Africa, where people absolutely wanted to be free, and they were, you know, there was such an incredible and sustained effort to change the government and to change racist institutions at every level of society. So because of those intense dynamics, experts cannot, should not expect and shouldn't, I don't think, should be described as people who are able to just set out, able to just kind of create society according to their own image. So I think in a way my book was a call for humility. And when we think about the role of experts, it is very, very easy to assume that knowledge equals power and that quantification is always going to give states more power. And both with the debates about the so-called poor white question in South Africa and at the end of apartheid, there were times when government agencies were much more animated by qualitative knowledge, by stories, by life experience. And I just think it's really important to pay attention to these complexities, or again, we can kind of be like caught off guard. If you see how people in the past struggled and wrestled with the poverty question, I think it can maybe give people today and in the future a little bit more sort of patience with the difficulties of ever coming up with a totally compelling argument. It so much depends on the context and on the kinds of political forces that are in play.
Yeah, on the issue of the context, one of the things that seemed so relevant in all of the story, well, the early stories as well as the later stories, was just the presumption that there should be a stable labor force. And that was so much of the driving, it drove the way in which poverty was figured. I mean, it was the sort of questions that they were trying to address. So many of these concepts, the epistemic mobility and co-production, are so useful for looking at other topics. But we were wondering, and Trixie was wondering in particular, about the specificity of South Africa. So she's going to take the floor.
As I was, can I just jump in? As I was writing the book, I felt like I learned so much about American society. That's what was such a revelation. Well, I want to hear Trixie's question. I'm dying to hear Trixie's question, but I think, yes, in South Africa, it's quite distinctive. You know, every place is different, but and the rapid industrialization of the southern continent with the expansion of the mining industry created social labor dynamics that were different than in other places. But I think, in just to jump onto your question about the creation of a stable labor force, of course, this isn't the only place where this happened, and it was just so. How so? I mean, I think there's so many different ways in which racial capitalism in South Africa is quite similar to the way to racial capitalism in the United States, and you know, many people have made these connections over the years and comparisons over the years. There's George Fredrickson's wonderful comparative book, and but in terms of this, you know, creation of a stable labor force, in a way that is almost shocking if you go at it in a sort of liberal. With a liberal mindset that poverty experts were interested in sort of social uplift or development, it can be sort of shocking to see that a lot of the early conversations about poverty in South Africa were really about how to keep workers healthy enough that they could reliably produce profits for mining companies, but how to give them the cheapest possible diets. You know, how to make sure that people in the labor exporting areas and the so-called native reserves, later Bantustans, were healthy enough that they would be valuable to the economy, but without investing in a way that would lead to that, you know, had anything to do with full citizenship. So it's South African history is so stark and you know, morally just outrageous that. I think it can wake you up if you are not looking for these things in your own society. So, I just feel really grateful that I had the chance to think about these things and looking at another country, and it made me much more curious about how scientific concepts and expert knowledge has been formulated in this country. I think because I grew up in the United States, I was born in Washington, D.C., I think there's a lot of things it was hard to see because it was so close. Sometimes going someplace else, it allows you to see, look again at your own life. I got off track there. did you want to ask me your question?
Yeah, Trix is going to go for it. And we were just also commenting that reading the book, for anyone who's ever doubted the recentness and the acuteness of white supremacist thinking, I mean, the evidence that you show is just really, really shocking. But here's Trixie.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was wondering, with your academic background in African history, what was distinct about the concept of poverty knowledge in South Africa specifically that inspired your work?
Can you repeat the first part of the question, Trixie?
So what was distinct about the concept of poverty knowledge in South Africa specifically that inspired your work? Just considering your academic background in
history. Oh, in Africa. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes people who write about South Africa are accused of exceptionalism, as if South Africa is such a special place that, and they need to have a broader transnational perspective. I'm not sure. I'm getting a little tired. I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
I was wondering just, like, what stood out to you about poverty knowledge in South Africa?
Maybe another way to ask.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
It's like midterm time here, and I think my brain is on the fritz. Jump in, Laura.
Yeah, no, maybe another way to phrase it is just to sort of ask about what parts of the story don't transfer. You know, like what are the contingencies that just wouldn't work somewhere else? Because so much of the post-colonial literature also wants to caution against sort of treating the global South as one homogenous category. And so it's sort of the difficulty that we're sort of processing ourselves as a class of being able to make broad, even social justice claims and having useful concepts that you can move across different case studies, but then pointing to real specifics that make a context distinctive. You know, and so maybe the labor issue and the extremity of the racial hierarchy and the rigidity of it is maybe part of the answer of the distinctiveness of South Africa.
Yeah, maybe so. I also think I really believe in culture as a real thing. I mean, South Africa is such a vibrant, colorful, amazing culture. And it's such a complex place. I mean, the longer I was there, the less I felt like I understood what was going on. So in terms of what's distinctive about South Africa and translating, you know, categories and ideas across different contexts, I agree with you that we should not homogenize the global South. I'm not even sure global South is a term we should be using. I think, when I think of what's distinctive about South Africa, I think of like the personalities and just such brave, committed people in terms of intellectuals there and intellectual activists. There were just people who committed their lives, who were both, you know, Z.K. Matthews, both anthropologist, you know, great leader of African University, but also helped to co-write the Freedom Charter and went to jail. They're, you know, Ruth First, people who gave their lives for freedom in South Africa. And I think what's distinctive about it is that, you know, the white minority, which is also not homogenous, by the way, white minority was so determined to hold on to power, and had, you know, backed itself into such a corner by the 1980s that it really took incredibly creative, brilliant, inspired leadership and sustained leadership and also, you know, collaborative movement building across all these different locations internationally to end white minority rule. So I think one of the things that's distinctive about it is that the fight for democracy took so long and was driven forward by all these different generations of people, and not just leaders, but, you know, people who were taking action, you know, in all kinds of local ways that never make it into the historical record or into the, you know, that the media never picks up on. So I think one of the things that makes South Africa distinctive is just the commitment to what you might call grassroots organizing, to associations, to democratic consultation, and also to protest. I mean, people there for a long, long time have been willing to take risks, to organize, to speak out. So it's a very inspiring place to study, a question like poverty.
I think your answer is also helping me, maybe the others, also realize that one of the things you're trying to do is to avoid sort of the pitfall of falling into an exceptionalist narrative, into a South African exceptionalist narrative. So that's actually really clarifying things for me. I mean, the story continues to unfold, and Tessa was remarking about this in particular.
So your analysis takes us to all the way to 2005, and then in your epilogue you're speaking all the way to 2013. But I was wondering, I was wondering if you were writing this book today, and if you were extending your analysis beyond 2005, if there were any particular moments or like political events or moments in South African politics that you would want to
highlight or draw on right now. And what came to my mind was the establishment of the national minimum wage, which was described as not being actually a living wage, as one idea.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I haven't thought that much about how I would try to bring my analysis up to sort of current events in South Africa. I have to tell you, as I was writing this book, I realized I wanted to write my second book on U.S. history, and partly a project on the global anti-apartheid movement, but I've been totally immersing myself in really different archives and really different issues, and it's another history of human science question about corporate power and the sort of efforts by labor organizers and by so-called corporate researchers to understand how corporations think and how activists can, through various methods, force corporations to negotiate with unions and also to make like policy changes. So I've been trying as hard as I can to understand American history and sort of the history of what are now called union corporate campaigns. So I'm really deep into this new project, and I was really glad to talk with you all today because I hadn't thought about how epistemic mobility is actually central to my new research, but it is, because the activists and the labor organizers and the corporate researchers that I'm learning about and interviewing and researching, they were really obsessed with trying to get inside the mind of the corporation and the mind of the corporate board, because they believed, they sort of discovered this through trial and error, and partly informed by the drive for disinvestment and divestment and sanctions in the South African context. They were convinced that if they could understand what corporations really cared about, they could force them to make some change. And so they're really experimental and trying to understand, is it sort of psychological, social information that we need, or is it financial information? Do we need to understand their stock prices? So I think I'm continuing to find the epistemic mobility concept helpful, and the idea that, you know, the unsettledness of evidence is both a resource and kind of a danger in political struggle. But I have to say, if you ask me how my research applies to what's happening in South Africa today, I have to throw up my hands, because I feel like South African politics is so turbulent and active, and even what's happening this week with Zuma. And I hear there's going to be major protests on Friday, calling for his ouster. So there's so much going on, and I decided to kind of give myself a pass and say, okay, I'm not going to read the Mail and Guardian. I'm going to read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and try to understand what's been happening in this country for my new project. But you might be able to. I would love to, you know. I wish we could talk all day, because I would love to hear a bit more about your students and the research they're doing, and also the work that you're. I think one of you said you're working on housing in Cape Town, so I'd also love to be in touch with you about that.
Yeah, that was Tessa. I'm sure that they'll be in touch offline. Just to wrap up, I wanted to just ask one final question. I mean, to comment on sort of stepping out of an analysis of South African current politics, I mean, I think your book shows it's incredibly relevant for thinking about the terms of the debates for today. And so it's just really wonderful for those purposes. One of the things that as people in an academic setting found quite striking was that the book is as much about the practice of social justice as it is about social activists and different social movements. And so I just have to quote you from your epilogue, because I found it so striking and admirable.
And I have to say my epilogue is somewhat aspirational, so there's a lot of big ideas there, so I might be embarrassed. I might blush as you quote me, but go ahead.
Okay, all right, so tell us if you blush. The quote is, "It's not sufficient for students in the human sciences to learn primarily about debates in their subfields or about the latest and most fashionable research methods. Scholars training to engage in poverty-related research also need to learn politically intentional and anti-racist methods of supporting and participating in grassroots anti-poverty campaigns that are trying to do what successful nonviolent revolutions have done in the past to overthrow dictators." So almost taking the activists in your story, some of their elements, as positive models. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I was just wondering what this has looked like for you in your own life as a scholar.
What
the call to activism for us as scholars. What form does that take in your life?
I mean, I think what I would say about scholar activism is that there's so many ways to do scholar activism. And the last thing I would want to do with this book is to come across as if I'm sort of scolding people for not getting out there in the streets. I mean, that's not at all the tone I'm trying to convey. One of the most important sentences to me in that epilogue is about the real need for understanding. There's a real need for understanding health policy and where it comes from. There's a real need for just deep, nuanced, you know, sophisticated understanding of all kinds of policy issues, of racism, of capitalism, of the growth of the financial industry, of, just all the things that people are studying. So I don't want to give the sense that there is just one way to be a scholar activist. So I just mention a couple, maybe I think way to answer the question might be to mention some of the kinds of scholar activism that I find helpful and inspiring to think about, and again, just to realize that there's so many different ways to meld your political convictions with your research. So I think on one, is that okay if I approach it that way?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, and then I think I need to run. Just checking the time. Yeah. So, for example, I really love the work of Andrew Ross, who has written about, he's written about a lot of different things, but he's written about the global anti-sweatshop movement, organizing on campuses in the 80s and 90s to, you know, deal, to sort of confront the problem of sweatshop labor around the world. And he's a kind of scholar activist where he gets very involved in the organizing, and he goes out with activists, and I happened to meet him during Occupy Wall Street in New York City. He was very, Andrew Ross, who's at NYU, was very active in helping to promote and to create, rather, this group called Strike Debt, which set out to call attention to the student debt crisis and to the mortgage crisis and to all the ways in which debt is a burden and a kind of source of shame for so many people in different parts of society in different ways. And so he and, you know, a lot of people really successful in 2012 and 13 and building on the work other people are doing, kind of calling attention to debt as a problem, and then, you know, going out and organizing events and films and nonviolent civil disobedience actions and being out kind of putting their, you know, there's all these cliches about it, but, you know, putting your body on the line and putting. But I think that's just one way to do it. I mean, another kind of scholar activism is just to call attention to silences. My one reason I went to the University of Michigan is that I wanted to work with an anthropologist and historian named David William Cohen, and he wrote a book, a series of essays that were just really opened up a lot of questions for a lot of people, called The Combing of History. And at the very end, he gives a sort of list of the kinds of silences that you find in the historical record and in the ethnographic record. And he inspired lots of people, lots of students. He's a scholar activist in the sense that he, I think of him in that sense because he did so much to empower his students and his colleagues to kind of ask really brave, creative questions and to people like Carolyn Hamilton. He also, I think, was in conversation with Michelle Rolfe Trio when Trio was writing his wonderful book, Silencing the Past, about the Haitian Revolution. And so you know, that you can be a kind of, you can do scholar activism that is just committed to exploring silences that are connected to injustice and that are in some way connected to really sharp inequalities of in terms of power, and I think just being willing to kind of address those silences is a really important ethical contribution. And then I think there's, you know, in terms of the people I was writing about in my book, I was, in a way, I feel like I was radicalized by the activists I was researching, because they just were so spirited in what they were doing. And, you know, for example, Shula Marx and other people who were involved in the VITS social history, the history workshop. So people who in the, you know, 70s and 80s were very much involved in the liberation struggle, but doing it in all these really different creative ways, just, you know, showing, helping to read colonial documents sort of against the grain, in the sense of finding new information, new readings of the existing historical record that were quite radical and that were moving away from more comfortable liberal readings of history. So those, you know, that collective, you know, I think, so you, the one way to do it is to be involved to be sort of collaborating with other progressive thinkers who are asking important questions. So I could go on and on about it. I mean, I think, gosh, there's so many people who, you know, I guess another example might be Robin Kelly, who, if you know his work on American history and class and race in the U.S., I mean, he's somebody who partners with artists who are doing kind of musicians who are doing kind of visionary and quite radical work politically. So there's so many different ways to do it, and I think also you have to be ready to, there's different sort of moments in time. So one of my hopes is that this book might kind of prepare, I don't know if how many people will in South Africa will find the book useful, but I hope some people do, and I hope that in a way it could contribute to scholar activism in the sense of sort of preparing people for future struggles. I mean, South Africa has had these incredible dramatic struggles, but there will be future struggles over inequality. It's a very, the poverty question is totally unresolved. So I think having awareness and kind of sensitivity to some of the strange things that have happened in the past, and also some of the almost miraculous things that have happened in the past, is quite helpful to be sort of ready for, prepared for present and future dynamics.
Yeah, to see learning and asking questions as a form of protest at times itself.
Mm.
Grace, thanks so much for your time. You're so generous with us, and we really appreciated the book. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.